Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, welcome back. Thanks again for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. The number is 888-914-9149. We are a week away from Good Friday, and I'm inviting you to complete your Lenten journey with the Close to Jesus to the Last 5-day spiritual walkthrough of Jesus' final days before his passion. Father Rocky will guide you, and we will pause for an hour at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. Central Time each day to ponder the events that draw Jesus to Jerusalem, exploring each with especially selected music and prayers. Close to Jesus to the Last is a reverent transition from Lent to Easter, and it happens next week right here on Relevant Radio. I have an email I want to read before we go back to the phones. This is not age appropriate for children. So if you have children, either turn the radio down for 4 or 5 minutes or send the children to the other room. So for the family in Houston, California, if you're still listening right now, this is not for your children. And fair warning. Go ahead, Cyrus.
Ready, steady, go.
All right. You live for that, don't you?
Love it.
So this is an email that just came in from Dave. I was just checking again to make sure that it wasn't something that he wanted to be anonymous, but he didn't say that. He says, Patrick, I love your show and great advice. I need your help and guidance. I'm in a loving 38-year marriage with my wife, but since she went through menopause and had some medical issues, she has lost all interest in any intimacy. He says, I'm in fairly good health and I still have sexual desire. I have confessed. Whoops, I went a little too far down that page. There we go. I have confessed over and over about viewing pornography and masturbating, but haven't been given any priestly advice on alternatives. I'll never go outside our marriage, but I need occasional sexual relief. Well, let's talk turkey here. First thing to know is that the reason that you've been going to confession because of these sins, first of all, it's good that you're going to confession, but the reason you need to go to confession is because there are serious sins and they are contrary to your status as a married man. It's contrary to the status of an unmarried man, but for different reasons, or at least some of the reasons are different. But in your case, that's not a solution. And it will create more and more harm, not only to you spiritually, but also to your marriage. And you didn't mention whether or not this is something that your wife is aware of, but either way, my advice would be, let her know that you're really in a difficult situation here. And it may be that because she loves you, you have many years together. I'm assuming you probably have children and so much of your experience in life together for all those years, that on the basis of all that, that if you were to just open up to her and reveal to her how difficult this is to you, for you, and how you're not doing too well in this area because you want this part of your marriage and you realize that for legitimate reasons, she has lost interest in it. But ask her if she could overcome that lack of interest so that you are not as tempted as you are to do the things you've been doing. I would just ask her and have a really honest, open, heartfelt conversation, maybe more than one conversation. St. Paul, Dave, says that married couples should, from time to time, be apart from each other in this way for the sake of kind of building up their spiritual life and whatnot, because the danger of hedonism is always present, even in marriage, and this is one of those benefits of marriage, is probably the chief benefit of marriage. And so it's an important part of marriage, but it's by no means the most important part of marriage, but it is an important part of marriage. And you have a right to this. Your wife has a right to this. Now, when medical situations arise and she can't help it, it's not her fault, so we're not blaming her at all. But assuming that it wouldn't be harmful to her, that there would not be something about this activity that would put her health in jeopardy, I'm guessing probably it wouldn't, it seems that you have a good chance of her recognizing this and saying, oh, I didn't realize that. Let's make this work, in other words. That's the solution. That's really the solution for your situation. Draw her into this situation and let her know how you feel about it. Let her know what your struggles are about this. And I would be confident that you will see some improvement. Now, obviously, ask the Lord for his grace in the situation, because his grace is so necessary for marriage in any case. And in this way in particular, ask the Lord to bless your marriage with a new degree of physical intimacy, emotional intimacy, whatever is lacking. Ask the Lord to give you your heart's desire, because this is good. This is something the Lord wants for married couples. He ordained it to be this way. So it's not as though you're asking the Lord for something that's not appropriate for you. It is appropriate for you and for her. But be gentle, be honest, be open. Definitely, definitely stop the things that you mentioned that you're confessing. That's not the solution. It will only make things worse. So that's my heartfelt advice. And I hope that's helpful to you, Dave. I really do. I really pray that this will be a breakthrough for you and your wife. 888-914-9149. Back to the phones. Let's go to Chris now in the Bay Area. Hi, Chris.
Hey, yeah, I got a question. Okay. You know how in the past there have been stories where, you know, you have a priest who does something that's a little rogue in the actual physical church, not the church as the body of Christ, but in his parish. So we're invited to a wedding, and I spoke with the groom, and it's their priest from their Catholic okay. parish, and they're both Catholic, and the ceremony is going to be not in the actual building of the church. They're going to get married with this priest outside in the woods. So my question is, is that ever, for whatever, is that ever a thing, a good thing? I don't know.
Well, ordinarily, no. So the church's law requires that for a valid marriage, that the Catholic couple get married in a church in front of an official witness being a deacon, priest, or bishop. But it is
right.
possible that a bishop can give a dispensation. So not knowing what happened here, this leads to another question. If this is an actual Catholic priest in good standing in his diocese, then it's possible that he helped the married couple, or the couple rather, get a dispensation from the bishop. So you should inquire, you know, did the bishop
okay.
say this was okay? Okay. Now, if the priest is going rogue and he's just freelancing and doing this, well, he knows better, and who knows why he would do this, but if he didn't, if there was no dispensation, or if the bishop didn't delegate that to him, then he's doing something that by its very essence would make that marriage null from the beginning. So he would be presiding
right.
over a okay.
Right.
All right. Now, the other issue is, it's possible, well, maybe not, because you said you know who the priest is, right? So is he a priest of the diocese?
I know the church. I know the church. It's a diocese it's the San Jose diocese. So I know the church.
Well, I'm not asking about that. What I mean is, do you know that the priest is a priest of the diocese? And here's why I ask, because there are rogue priests who are not in good standing and who aren't in communion with their bishop, and they rent themselves out for things just like this. And they advertise for things just like this. Yeah, I'm a priest, but I'm not, you know, doing anything in the Catholic Church anymore. But you, for $500, I'll come and marry you in the woods. So there are guys like that out there. So that's why I was wondering if this particular priest, if you knew
right.
if he was
yeah.
in the diocese or not.
Got it. Okay. Okay. All right. Then I will... Okay, well, we will see. All right. Thank
yeah.
you.
All right. Well, I hope that the bishop said, okay, under these circumstances, I'll grant you a dispensation. But if he didn't, then maybe you're in a good position, Chris, to let them know that, you know, you guys are going to have an invalid marriage. So best not to do this. Thank you. Let's go to Corrine now in Arizona. Good morning, Corrine.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Good. I have a question. So I was raised Catholic and then now have been fully practicing for the last year. And my friend who I'm close with is getting married. And she has actually asked me to marry her. And so I need to have a conversation with her. She is a non-denominational Christian. And I believe she's not planning on getting married in any church. And she does, you know, our relationship, we have talked about praying and God and connected in those aspects that are not, you know, religion sectorized. But I need to basically, I'm meeting with her next week to tell her that I'm not marrying her and I'm trying to figure out how to support her in her marriage. I have an idea that she'll be upset or feel hurt by that, but I'm just looking for advice on what to advise her on. I'm also not like a marriage expert myself. I'm not married. So.
Okay. I have a couple questions that might help me. So you say that she's non-denominational. She was never Catholic, I presume, right? She's always been Protestant?
Correct.
Okay. And the man she's marrying, is he also Protestant? Is he nothing? Has he ever been baptized? Do you know?
I don't know if he's been baptized. I think he goes to church with her. But I don't know if they pray together or things like that. I'm not sure what.
Okay. The reason I asked that question is because they can have a valid marriage and they could go to the justice of the peace. They could get married by the minister of her church. They could get married by, you know, whoever is legally deputed to be able to witness a marriage legally. They could get married in any of those scenarios. Ideally, I mean, if they got married at her church, it would have a nice essence of the faith involved, or at least faith in Jesus involved. But because she's not a Catholic, she would be able to get married in one of those settings. I'm going to come back to the issue of you being the, you know, the officiator in a minute. But I think the question I would ask her is, if the man you're going to marry is also baptized, if he was ever baptized. Now, if he's a Catholic, that presents a problem because Catholics cannot get married under those circumstances without permission. So let's assume that he's baptized, but he was always Protestant, some generic non-denominational Protestant. Well, she and he could get married at the justice of the peace. It would be a valid marriage. And in the case of two baptized people, it would be presumed also sacramental. Even though they may not realize it, it would be presumed sacramental as well by virtue of their baptism. But if he's not baptized, then they could get married also at, say, the justice of the peace. But their marriage would be valid or presumed valid, but it wouldn't be sacramental. But in either case, because you're a Catholic and because you are a laywoman, it's not appropriate for you. And it sounds like you already made your decision. So I guess I just want to reinforce your decision to say no. It would not be appropriate or proper for you to be in that position because as a Catholic, you recognize that the, you know, for Christian marriage, that a priest or bishop or deacon in some cases would be the church's official witness to this marriage. Now, there are times and places where if there is no priest, and maybe he won't be there to visit the village for the next year or so, couples have a right to marry if they want to, and they're free to marry because the husband and the wife confer the vows upon each other. They confer the sacrament upon each other. But because in her case, she's not a Catholic, there's more latitude there. So there's more latitude there for her, but my advice to you would be follow your course of action and politely decline and just say, I'll be happy to be there to celebrate with you. I'll be happy to be there as a witness. I'll be your maid of honor, whatever you'd like. But I can't take that role of getting my, you know, sending in my $100 to get a certificate from some place that says I'm now legally a minister to perform marriages. That's all bogus. So I definitely wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Okay. That's helpful. It's hard recently with friends that are not Catholic or have some kind of faith, but also unclear for themselves where they're at in their own faith journey for me to try to have these discussions with them about you know, this is why I'm not doing this or that. And I've had some gay friends have baby showers, and it's like, do I go to them? Do I not go to them? And it just seems like it's coming up more for me to kind of have these discussions and let down people, but still be able to walk in my faith. So I appreciate the insight.
Far better. You're welcome. Far better that you disappoint a gay friend than you disappoint God. If you had to make a decision, a choice between who do I disappoint, I'd rather not disappoint God. I don't want to disappoint other people if I can avoid it, but sometimes it's unavoidable.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Corrine. Very nice to chat with you. Why don't we take a break? We'll come back to the phones right on the other side of this quick timeout. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code PATRICK for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Okay, let's get going. 888-914-9149. How about Becky in Houston? Good morning, Becky.
Oh, good morning, Patrick. Thank you for having me.
Sure, welcome.
I appreciate your saying earlier that the real issue is which interpretation of the Bible is right, and even in relation to transgenderism, now in my case. So I need your help in responding to a question from a young person who describes himself as transgender, but he's still in process of earning the money needed to go through hormone therapy rather than chasing heroin and crack. He says he believes in God, but he's not Christian or religious. And this is his question. I'm quoting now. Did you know in the Bible, God is actually described androgynously? In other words, God is both male and female. Seriously, go back and read Genesis. Let us make man in our own image, one male and one female, our image. That is a quote.
Okay.
How would you respond?
Okay. Well, this is not a difficult one to unravel, so let's start at the top. First of all, you point out to him that God is neither male nor female. He transcends gender. And the reason is, unlike human beings, God is a pure spirit. God doesn't have a body.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have sexual organs. He doesn't have eyes or ears, or he doesn't have a body. He doesn't take up space. He's a pure spirit. The reason that human beings are gendered, the reason we have the sex of male and the sex of female, is because we procreate. And human beings procreate through the union of male and female. Angels, who are more like God and not like us in that regard, they don't procreate. And angels also are neither male nor female. So the mistake at the beginning of his analysis of this is to assume that because the anthropomorphic language — anthropomorphic is just a fancy word that it means language that explains things about God in terms that are human, so like the right hand of God, or God sees, or God, you know, hears — those are anthropomorphic terms that are a way to try to explain to us in human terms how God is, but they don't really describe God accurately, because God doesn't have ears, he doesn't have eyes, again, pure spirit. So that's the first thing. Gender is a construct, it's not a social construct. It's a God construct. God constructed or God designed human beings to be male and female for the purpose of procreation. So that'd be the first thing I would point out, that he's hitting the bullseye on the wrong target. Okay. Second thing is that, yes, indeed, it does say God said, let us make man in our image. But in that passage, it doesn't say anything about male or female. And certainly doesn't say anything male or female with regard to God himself. Jesus says in Matthew 19 that God made them male and female, referring to Adam and Eve. So the paradigm of God's creation of human beings is the binary. Male and female. There were no third or fourth or fifth options. So what he's doing is he's taking, I assume it's a he, I don't know, but he's taking passages from Scripture and reading things into them that not only do they not say, but they also, they don't mean what he's suggesting. So maybe if you start there, you can help him see that he's actually misunderstanding the very verses he's quoting.
Right. Thank you. I did recommend the website.
Welcome.
Sexchangeregret.com.
Yeah.
But
right.
He thinks that targets youth like himself, and he says it causes youth to believe that they need fixing, which leads them to depression and suicide. So he said he wishes that he had had gender care when he was young and explored that. It would have helped him. He loves being transgender. He loves that community. It's like his real family. So I just wanted to give him food for thought, though, that when he quotes the Bible here, you know, he needs to understand what the true interpretation is. It's a good
question. Ask him if he thinks that the people who don't accept the transgender movement, ask him if he thinks that do they need fixing? Do they need a change of attitude on this issue or not? See what he says. I'll bet you he'll say yes. Ask him if he thinks that people who don't currently accept the transgender ideological demands and the premises involved.
Yeah.
Ask him if he thinks they need fixing. What do you think he'd say?
Yes, they do.
Right.
Because he.
Yeah. So you could point out that in his mind, there is a group of people who are deluded because they believe something that he thinks is not true. So what you can say to him is, well, this is simply just the mirror image. You do need fixing, at least in terms of your understanding of yourself and who you are, and your feelings, your emotions are not, and your sexual urges, for that matter, are not the ultimate standard of determining reality. So if you can say, meaning him, if you can say that all those other people who don't accept your worldview need fixing, well, it's equally fair for them to say that you need fixing. You can't both be right.
Okay. True.
And then maybe that's where you can say that part of the problem here is that the other side of the equation, the people who are saying no to the transgender ideology, they have science on their side. Physiology and genetic science, chromosomal science, anatomical science to back up what we're saying. It's not just us saying, well, this is what we think and there's no evidence to back it up. All the evidence is on the side of the people who are saying no to this delusion. And maybe you can use a parallel to say, ask him if you yourself. Now, I don't know what your racial background is. There's no way for me to know what your racial background is. So I'm going to throw a dart and assume that you're probably white. Would that be correct?
Yes.
Okay. So ask him if he would agree that you should be able to identify as black so that you can make use of affirmative action quotas and get into Harvard. Because if you put on the form that you're black, then you should be, and you identify as black. So who can argue with that? Ask him if it would be okay to do that and see what he says.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting is that in the world of sexual identity, people, they insist that they should be free to do whatever they want, whenever they want, meaning that they can change their sexual identity or think they can, and everybody has to agree with it and gender them properly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Ask them if the same thing applies to your race. And if it doesn't apply, why doesn't it apply? What you can do here is, using questions like this, you could begin to break down the illogic of his position. And it will break down very quickly. And as it begins to break down, maybe he can begin to see that he's clinging to a delusion. It's not rooted in reality. It's not rooted in science.
No.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, good. That's going to help a great deal. I didn't think of turning it that way. And one thing I do remember is what Monsignor Sweatland said one time when he had a broadcast on Relevant Radio. Gender is a gift from God to be learned how to use throughout life. And for me, that sums it up very well. But in speaking to someone else who is thinking the way this man is, I didn't really know an approach. And so thank you very much, Patrick, for helping me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I think originally that was a direct quote from Pope John Paul II, but it's a very good quote.
Oh,
did you have something
really?
Else you wanted to
I didn't
add?
Know that. No, I don't. And I just appreciate very much your helping me give him food for thought so he can think.
I hope it's helpful. I'm sorry. Your phone is cutting in and out.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. All right. Thanks a lot. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to, where are we going to go? Let's go to Mark in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. Hello, Mark. You're on the air. All right, Mark is not ready, so let's get Mark sorted. We'll get Mark sorted, and I'll come back. Hey, everybody, that's something to remember. When you get on hold, please keep the phone up to your ear, because I could come to you, and if you're down the hall making a sandwich because you think I'm not going to come to you, that's usually when I come to you. So stay ready. Stay alert. Let's go to John in Illinois. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question regarding the consecration and transubstantiation. Try to say that three times. during daily mass, our priest uses only water, no wine. And giving, you know, the church's precepts of the essential elements of communion, does consecration take place? And does transubstantiation take place in that situation?
No. A definite, emphatic no. But here's my question, and I'm not trying to be argumentative, John. How do you know that he's not using any wine?
I've asked him.
Ah, okay.
And I mean,
so he is
not only that, but he has the cruet set on the altar. He only has water. On the weekends, he uses wine. But during the week, he only uses water, and his response is, it's the precious blood. I use the precious blood.
All right. I want to unravel that a bit further, but if that is the actual, and I believe you, don't misunderstand me. If that's actually what's happening, this is crazy on stilts, and he absolutely is not celebrating a valid mass, and water by itself is invalid matter for consecration for the precious blood.
Yes.
So this is not only is it a grave sin that he's committing, it's also a canonical crime that he's committing, because, among other things, he is committing the canonical crime of fostering idolatry, because those in the congregation who are both adoring Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament, or what they think is the Blessed Sacrament, it's material idolatry, which is a grave sin. Now, they're not guilty of it formally because they don't know, or I suppose they don't know. But also when they receive Holy Communion and they think they're receiving the precious blood, although COVID has done away with that for the time being at least. Yeah, this is grave sin and a canonical crime. So not only should you tell him knock it off, but somebody's got to tell his bishop. This priest is willfully, intentionally, at times celebrating Mass using only water and not valid matter. The bishop needs to know so he can shut that down.
Okay. Now, even the host is not consecrated. Is that correct?
Well, that's a theological question there. So here's why this is a question. that's open for discussion. I personally hold a view that because, well, there are two things to keep in mind here. First of all, that the consecration as such, which begins with what's called the epiclesis, sometimes people will say the epiclesis, that's where the priest extends his hands side by side, palms down over the gifts at the beginning of the canon, and he invokes the Holy Spirit to come upon these gifts. That's the beginning of what we could think of as a single unified Eucharistic action on the part of the priest that includes or leads to consecration of the species. So the first thing to remember is it's one single act, but nonetheless, the first element that is consecrated or transubstantiated would be the host. And so the host, if it's a valid matter, and that would be unleavened wheat bread with no additives, no butter, no sugar, no salt, no nothing, just unleavened wheat bread. If that's valid and the formula that he uses is valid, who knows? With this guy, who knows? The third part may be what invalidates that, and that would be if he doesn't intend to do what the church does, if he doesn't intend to do to consecrate the host and the precious blood. And by evidence of the fact that he's not using wine, which is the valid matter, he's using water only, it may well be that he has a defective intention, in other words. So among theologians who might argue about this, or canonists, for example, I could see a case to be made that the first part of this single Eucharistic action could be considered invalid because he doesn't have the proper intention to consecrate the host. It's also possible that he does have the proper intention to consecrate the host, and this is where something important has to be said, and that is that you'll notice that when the host is consecrated, the priest holds it up. He elevates the host. And this, by the way, didn't really get started until around the 12th century, and it started in Paris, apparently, in the Western Church. Before that, it wasn't customary for the priest to raise the host. But the reason he did it was because the priest and the people are facing the same direction. They're facing the Lord together, which is the best way, if you ask me, ad orientem. And so the people would know when the consecration took place, the bells would ring, and also the priest would elevate the host so that the people could adore Jesus in the host. So the traditional understanding is that that is valid in and of itself because the people are adoring the host, adoring Jesus present in the host, and that precedes the consecration of the chalice, the contents of the chalice. So I don't know that the church has ever settled that question definitively one way or the other. But if I had to guess, if he's that, I want to choose my words carefully here, if he is that deeply misguided that he thinks it's okay to use invalid matter for the chalice, I would personally be very suspicious that he doesn't have a valid intention, or his intention is distorted or deformed. Now, it'd be up to his bishop to determine that. But either way, it doesn't matter. What he's doing is seriously wrong. Seriously, seriously, seriously wrong. And the bishop should know about it.
Okay. Well, yeah, I've tried calling the diocese, and nobody seems to want to touch it. So
here's the thing, though, and I talked about this, I think it was yesterday or it was the day before. Put it in writing. Because an official letter written directly to your bishop or to the moderator of the curia, or, you know, that is much more, because it's official and it's on paper, it takes on a different sense of gravity. A phone call does not have the same level of gravity.
Okay.
It's my advice.
Okay. So there's not a black and white answer.
Yes, there is. I thought I just gave it. No disrespect, but I thought I just gave a black and white answer. This is seriously, seriously wrong.
This
serious
is serious
for him.
But we don't really know if the host is being transubstantiated then. Am I correct? It depends on his intent.
Well, it certainly depends upon his intent regardless. In order for a valid Eucharist to be celebrated, you have to have valid form, valid matter, and valid and proper intention. So the question remains, does he have the valid intention for consecrating the host? It's possible that he might. As I said a moment ago, yeah. I would assume he probably doesn't. But the whole thing, the whole Mass now has been rendered invalid, even if maybe technically there might be validity for the consecration of the Holy Eucharist. The Mass is illicit, and I would argue invalid. It's very black and white.
Okay. Okay. Very good.
All right, John. Thank you. What a terrible, horrible thing to have to talk about. But by all means, do let the bishop know. Maybe start with the priest and tell him, you know, what you're doing is wrong. And I don't know how much progress you'll make there, but bump it up. That's what I would do. I hate those kinds of topics to discuss, but every so often we have to. Take a break and we'll come right back.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Real life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right. All right. Got the words backwards. Back to the phones. Ernie in Marco, Florida. Is it Marco Island, Florida, or Marco, Florida?
It's Marco Island, Florida.
Well, welcome aboard.
Hello. Well, yes. Thank you. Patrick, thank you. I called you last week. I think you may remember that my brother was seriously ill and dying in a hospital up north, and I'm in Florida, and the priest that was from the hospital came to the hospital room, and he would not come in the room because my brother had had COVID. And he did the last rites outside. Do you remember that? I just wanted to let you know, thank you very much, because we were able to get a priest from the parish there. And he did come and he did administer all the anointing.
Uh-oh, what happened?
And I just wanted to thank you for urging me to do that. And I just had one other question. I was able to FaceTime with him, even though he was not conscious. He was sleeping. And my daughter was there, and she held his hand. And I said the Divine Mercy chaplet in full, because nobody there had it with
them. Wonderful.
Do you think that was valid remotely?
Yes, kind of absolutely. Yeah, there's no valid or invalid when it comes to praying for people. You could be in the North Pole and pray for me or pray for Cyrus, and your prayers are just as efficacious. So what a wonderful thing that you were able to have FaceTime so you could at least see him when you were doing this. But yeah, what a wonderful outcome. I'm so happy for you.
Oh, thank you very much. And I did feel much more peaceful after that. So, and I thank you, because once I found out, too, that the priest had come and that you did agree that that was not valid, even though the original priest said it was. And then people are praying for us here, and I just felt the results, because I don't know how I thought of FaceTiming all of a sudden, but I was very fortunate. And thank you.
Oh,
it's so nice to hear that you feel it's valid also.
Yes.
Because thank you again, and thank you again for
taking my call.
I listened to
I'm happy to take your call. Well, twice now. I'm happy both times.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much. And it's been a pleasure
listening
to you for years. I've been listening to Relevant Radio, and you're one of my very favorites. So thank you.
I appreciate it.
Too.
Thank you, Ernie.
And you are in my prayers also, along with everyone at Relevant Radio.
We all really appreciate that. We really do, Ernie. Thank you. I can hear the happiness in your voice. That makes me happy. Thank you. How about Jean now in St. Paul, Minnesota? Good morning, Jean.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Hello? Oh, okay.
Yes, sorry. I can hear you.
Okay. I have two questions. They're related, but they're different issues. I have a nephew who... I've watched all his life. He's at my house frequently, and we freely exchange his comings and goings, his toys, his whatever. And a couple of years ago, my elderly mother gave him a magic eight ball for Christmas, which I know she doesn't know anything about that. And I was just like aghast Well, I removed it from his house, and back when it was in his back corner of his closet, and I destroyed the thing. And he's never asked about it. I'm sure he doesn't even remember that he ever had it, whatever. So that's my first question. You know, okay, yeah, I took it from his house, but again, we freely exchange stuff all the time, and it may be at my house or maybe at his house. The other one is just this Christmas, he received a chakra bracelet from his mother, and he loves it, and he's had it on his arm ever since, and that has sickened me. She is not receptive to most things that I say, and however, last week he took it off, and it's been laying on my kitchen counter. So now I have the dilemma of, what do I do with it? I don't want it in my house. I don't know where I stand on that, because I know the result that I will get if I bring it up to his mother.
All right. How old is this nephew?
He just turned 10.
Okay. So maybe, I'm reading between the lines here, are you wrestling with wondering whether or not you committed theft by taking the eight ball, magic eight ball, and taking a hammer to it?
Eight ball, that's what I'm thinking. Is that something I have to confess?
Well, you know, it's interesting. First of all, I would not say that there's anything wrong with the magic eight ball. I remember that toy in the 1960s or whenever it came out. And it's just a goofy toy that whenever you turn it upside down, there's a set number of pre-programmed answers, definitely, or I wouldn't do that, or whatever the answers were. It's just a randomized speaker, you know, that says these things that are programmed into it. It's not a Ouija board. It's not like a Ouija board. It's never really been anything associated with the occult. It's just a, you know, a goofy game. And what's funny is when you ask a question, if the answer is kind of, you know, well, I can't think of an example. I just remember as a kid, I just thought of it as just kind of a goofy, silly game. So in itself, I personally don't think that there was any need for you to do that. I can understand your motivation for wanting to get something out of there. So let's say if it were a Ouija board, that would be something more, or if you found tarot cards or something like that. The question really is, do you have a right to take somebody else's property and destroy it? Well, I don't know exactly how I would personally, you know, I have to think about that. But on the one hand, you could say that, you know, if there were matches in that house and he was playing with matches and I took the matches away and I threw them away, technically you're taking something that doesn't belong to you, but you have a good enough reason for doing that because you're saving the child from burning the house down. So there is a time and place where it would be appropriate to do that. This to me seems like your motivation was well-intentioned. You're his aunt after all. You have a standing as a family member. You thought it was something harmful to him and you took it out of the way for that reason. But since your conscience is bothering you, Gene, I mean, obviously it is to some extent, otherwise you wouldn't be calling me about it. I would bring it up. Just mention it in confession. Just say, this happened in the moment. I didn't think it was something sinful, but now I'm not so sure because my conscience is bothering me and I just want to confess it just in case. And then I would just leave it at that. Now, as far as the chakra bracelet is concerned, did I hear you say that he left that at your house? Kind of left it behind there?
Yeah, he took it off and it's been on my kitchen counter.
Okay, so what you could do there is you could just put it away somewhere out of sight, out of mind, and maybe you might put it away in the trash can, or you might put it away, you know, someplace where it won't necessarily stay there. But it's your house and you have a right to dispose of things like that. Now, the fact that it's something that belongs to him might complicate matters a great deal, but this is definitely something that I wouldn't let one of my kids have. It's a Hindu religious object, and that's incompatible with faith in Jesus Christ. So I don't think that removing that from circulation would be a problem. Again, if your conscience bothered you, you could always bring it up and leave it there. But it sounds like you're a good aunt because you're maybe more vigilant with him than his own parents are. So maybe have a conversation with him about this and give him some good stuff he could wear and make use of. That might be a good substitute for these things. Thank you. Let's go now to Alejandro in Norwalk, California. Good morning, Alejandro.
Hello, Patrick. Oh, listen, a lady called, and I want to make a comment, and then I call you back for my original purpose. I want to make a comment. I think it's more important for that lady that called about somebody is trying to gender, exchange his gender. Can I make a comment rather than,
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, you know that there are two type of gay guys, right? Right.
Well, go ahead and make the comment. Go ahead and make the comment.
Okay, 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 okay. I'm sorry. Okay, okay. The two type, the feminine guy and the macho guy, right? So.
What's the comment?
So, the comment is like he doesn't need to go to exchange. You know, it's not really necessary for somebody to feel the way the person feels. He can be loved as he is. He doesn't have to be changed to a woman, whatever, to feel like a woman.
All right. Well, what I can tell you about that is that everybody is made by God out of love and for love, and we seek love, sometimes in a confused and mistaken way. So because we're human and we are very often ruled by, if you allow that to happen, ruled by your passions and your appetites, there are some people for whom their sexual appetite can be confused with true love. And that's a distortion. It can happen to homosexuals. It can happen to heterosexuals, and does. So we're not saying that people are not made for love and that they shouldn't seek love, but we have to seek it in the right way, and we have to seek the right kinds of love. Not everything that is called love is love. So sexual perversion, whether it's homosexual or heterosexual, is not love. It's a species of lust, perhaps, but it's not love. So perhaps that's the missing key there for the point that you're bringing up. Thank you, Alejandro. Let's see if we can go now to Sophie in Chicago. Hi, Sophie.
Hey, good morning. I have a question about deacon. What the deacon supposed to do in a church? What is his role?
Well, you're talking about in Mass, right?
Yes.
All right. Well,
our deacon is like, he never knew. Maybe he has a bike problem, but when the priest, you know, in consecration changed the wine, lift the chalice and put it down, and kneel, he just jumped and just closed it like the God will escape or something.
Right. I know, obviously, that's not, I understand what you're saying. So in the interest of time, there is a role for the deacon to assist at the altar, and sometimes that would include turning the pages of the sacramentary, which is the book that's on the altar that the priest is reading from when he celebrates Mass. There are moments in the Mass where, for example, the deacon would take the chalice cover off of the top of the chalice, or he might move some of the sacred vessels to different places on the altar. So those are all things that the deacons are sometimes doing at Mass, not always, but sometimes. And when they're not doing those things, when it's not required that they stand at the altar, behind the priest a ways, then they are supposed to kneel during the consecration. The deacons are supposed to kneel unless he has this duty at the altar to help the priest and turn the page of the sacramentary, etc. If that's what he's doing, then he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. But if he's not doing those things and the priest is turning the pages of the sacramentary and he is doing these other things, then the deacon is supposed to kneel. Now, some diaconate training programs are more thorough and better than others, so it's hard to say whether or not maybe he missed class that day. But assuming he's not helping at the altar in the way that I just described, he's supposed to kneel. That's what the rubrics call for. Hope that's helpful to you. And I sure enjoyed talking to all of you. I look forward to being with you again on the show very soon. Until then, I will pray for you. Please do pray for me. I would sure appreciate that. Your prayers today and every day. I'll pray for you every day as well. God bless you.